Welcome, everybody, to the NFL Legend Show on the Grueling Crew Sports Network. I'm your host, Mike Goodpaster. And before we get into this, make sure you check out BetMGM for the best sports book. For betting on the Super Bowl or any sport you want, click on the link in the description down below if you're watching on YouTube to check out BetMGM. All right, guys, we have a special guest today. If you're a Notre Dame fan, a Pittsburgh Steelers fan, or a fan of the 1976 Tampa Bay Buccaneers, you'll remember this man. In 1966, finished sixth in the Heisman voting, helped lead the Notre Dame Fighting Irish to the national championship in that iconic 10-10 tie with Michigan State. Went on to win two Super Bowl rings with the Pittsburgh Steelers. Help me welcome to the show, Terry Hanratty. How you doing, Terry?
Very good, Mike. Very good. Enjoying all the football, and I'm sorry to see it ending soon here.
Yeah, because then it goes to baseball season, and that can get kind of boring, Terry.
I can't do spring football though. I'll go to baseball.
Yeah, me too. I can't get into the spring football, but we brought up Notre Dame, and I thought it was interesting. You came from Butler High School in the Pittsburgh area, which was, I thought I saw that your coach had sent like 62 guys to the NFL while he was there. You want to talk a little bit about the culture and what it was like growing up in Butler?
Now that was 62 kids in a 20-year period to D1 football,
Oh, D1 football. That's what I
not to the
saw.
NFL.
But that's still impressive as hell, though.
That really is. I mean, we were a real, I would say at the time, one of the better teams in the country. I mean, we were that good. We were, that deep, and we had guys that were going to Michigan State, to Penn State, to Alabama, to Notre Dame, so all the major programs in that D1 category. And what's really interesting, I think, is what Butler is the makeup of the town is about 15,000 people. And we had the mid, we didn't have Pop Warner. We had midget league football, they called it. Same age limits.
Yeah.
And wherever you lived, and if you dissect, you put the town of Butler in a pie, we'll say six. I think there are about six teams. So you divide that pie up, it gets even more diminished of the kids in that area. And from our team in eighth grade, midget league football, three out of the four guys in my backfield played at least 8 years in the pros.
That's not a bad track record. So I'm sure you guys won some high school games. But I also read that you were a big fan of Duffy Daugherty and Michigan State. Now, living in Pennsylvania, how did you become a Michigan State fan?
Well, they recruited me. I
Yeah.
was fortunate to have, several many coaches come to Butler because, we had such a long line of kids going to D1. The most of the coaches were already in the, they w Butler was on their stop as they were, going through Western Pennsylvania. So he had a lot of people coming through anyway. And, I went up to Michigan State, and Duffy's from Scranton, PA originally. And, we just hit it off really well. And I thought for sure that I was going to go to Michigan State. And then, lo and behold, I meet Arrow. Spent about 2 hours with him in Pittsburgh, and we had lunch. And it was I came home and told my mother I'm going to Notre Dame, and
Yeah,
she said, "Well, what are you going to?"
so what was that lunch? Well, I know Bear Bryant, was after you. Most teams were after you. And Notre Dame, Eric Parseghian, who is a guy I think when all-time great coaches is bringing up, is far too often left off that list because, I mean, he turned around Northwestern, he went to Notre Dame, and they were dominant the entire time he was there. So what was that meeting like with Eric? And do you remember the point in your conversation where you started thinking, man, I might want to go here?
Well, I remember almost every word that was spent that day. We met at the old Hilton Hotel in Pittsburgh in the coffee shop, and I can remember looking at the menu, and I see this steak sandwich, and we didn't have steak back then. We had
Yeah.
those Jiffy steaks, those things you could barely chew, and I'm looking, it was like $3.95 for the steak sandwich, and I looked at him. I remember saying to myself, if I get this, will he think I'm gouging him? So I went for the club sandwich for a buck and a quarter plus I ordered French fries. But we ate, we sat there for about 2 hours and we talked about everything. And I felt so very comfortable because, my parents were separated. And so I guess I was, going on to that father figure. And Eric just settled, he was that guy. And we talked as much about life as we did about football. And it was just, you get that feel. And I was 17 years old at the time. And so you figure, you know, I made a pretty good decision in my 17th year.
Yeah, and what a lot of people don't realize, you get there in 1965, you're not eligible to play because freshmen weren't eligible to play back then. How difficult was it for you to not be able to play?
It was the bad part about it, the only thing you did was every Monday we had what they called the toilet bowl. And that was the freshman playing against the varsity who didn't play well on Saturday or didn't play at all.
Yeah.
So both of those guys were pissed off. So it was a bloodbath, you know, the freshman catching the blood. But, you know, I made it through that, and it was weird not to be able to play a game. But, you know, I go back to high school, and I think one of the remarkable things is, you know, I didn't start at quarterback until my senior year in high school. You know, we had a team back then. It was much like the old Ohio State. Woody Hayes, 3 yards in a cloud of dust.
Yeah.
We had the big offensive line with the fullbacks and, you know, just blew everybody out. But then when I got to be my senior year, boom, we scored 299 points in 9 games. You know, so we, you know, we were, the coach realized, well, hey, if you put that ball in the air, you know, good things could happen. So we played 9 games. So my 10th game, I started my sophomore year at Notre Dame, national TV against Purdue and Bob Greasy. The 10th game I ever started a quarterback. It was wild.
Yeah, and 1966, the season started off against Bob Greasy, and you had one of your best games. You and Jim Seymour, who was a great wide receiver. I think Seymour caught 3 touchdown passes in that game. And that was one of the few games where you guys gave up double digits. Your defense, when you look back at the scores, like there's like 5 shutouts or something in there, and hardly anybody broke double digits. Bob Greasy was the quarterback for Purdue then, and you guys ended up beating them 26-14. But the thing I remember is because I've been a Notre Dame fan my whole life, and I've seen the highlight film in a Purdue game so many times, and especially the 3rd touchdown. I think it was the right corner of the end zone where Jim Seymour goes up and gets it. That guy was a all-time great Notre Dame wide receiver.
Man, Jim was the perfect because, you know, he was 6'4", 6'5", and you throw the ball up high, and your average defensive back is probably going to be about 5'10", 5'11". So you just put it up high and just let Jim go for it. He's a good basketball player, you know, so he knows how to go get the ball.
All right, so you get to the Michigan State game. I mean, this is Duffy Daugherty, who you got along great with. You were thinking about going to Michigan State also. You had to know going into this game, this wasn't going to be blowouts like most of the other. You guys even beat Oklahoma at Oklahoma 38-0, I believe it was. You blew out
when they were, and they were ranked 6th in the country, Oklahoma.
Yeah, I mean, and you blew out USC 51-0, and both of those were top 10 teams. And then you get the Michigan State game against Duffy Daugherty's team with Bubba Smith. I mean, it was an all-time great Michigan State game team also. What are your recollections of that classic game?
Well, the first thing is, I think it's still the two best teams ever to play each other. Because if you look at both teams, what the All-Americans, the Hall of Famers, and whatnots on both sides of the ball, it was incredible. Michigan State was loaded. We were loaded. And those two teams were, you know, were incredible. I wish I could play the whole game, but Bubba was separated my shoulder in the first quarter.
Yeah.
So we lost myself, and we lost our running back, Nick Eddy, and our center, George Gedeke. So we were down, and Coley O'Brien committed and threw the touchdown pass to tie things up. And we had 1 game left in Southern Cal, and we beat them 51-0, and we became the national champions.
I mean, it's always good to go out west and beat USC 51-0, right?
It is, and they were ranked, you know, they were a top 10 team.
Yeah. And from there, like I said, you ended up 6th in the Heisman voting. We're going to fast forward a couple years. I don't want to keep you forever here, but you were a Pennsylvania native. Were you a Steelers fan growing up?
Oh, very much.
So,
you know, I grew up 30 miles north. So, you know, and at that time, the Steelers were not very good.
Yeah.
You know, and the thing about Pittsburgh back then, even when they lost a game, the teams hated to play the Steelers because they knew they were going to physically get beat up. You're going to beat them, but you're going to take some losses in the game.
So there's not a big ESPN NFL Network NFL draft show back in 1969. How did you find out you were drafted by the Steelers? And I got to imagine that being drafted by the Steelers, you probably wanted to go in the first round, but second round of the Steelers was probably fine by you.
Well, I just had my knee operated on. So I was in a cast, so there was that little question mark about my knee because it wasn't, you know, who knew how it was going to turn out. It turned out fine. But so I dropped to the second round. And back then, there wasn't any New York City where they took the, you know, the top three, you know, where they take the projected first round to come to New York. You know, you just sat in your room and your sports information director, back then Roger Valisseri, you know, he was calling every three or four draft picks and saying, well, so-and-so took so-and-so and bum, 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 down the line. Then it got to the second round and I'm going, oh boy, what's going to go on now? Then all of a sudden he called and said, the Steelers just took you in the second round. Then about 5 minutes later, I get a call from Chuck Knoll. You know, his first draft, he picked Joe Green in the first round and myself in the second round. And I was very happy to go to Pittsburgh. I mean, it was because you really can't, you know, I love being at Notre Dame for 4 years. And I'll be a Notre Dame fan all my life. And what I've learned there, I've carried on through my life. But then I was very fortunate enough to go to the Rooney family, which I think of the class of the NFL and just wonderful, wonderful people. And I spent, you know, 7 years there.
Yeah, and you got to play for Chuck Knoll. So how many people can say they played for Ara Parseghian, they played for Chuck Knoll, and John McKay will throw him in 1976.
Well, we don't need to.
No, we're not. That's why I said
well,
it kind of
you
sarcastic.
You got to throw Art Bernardi in.
Yeah, he offensive was, coordinator.
No. He was my high school coach.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
National Hall of Fame. So I played for Hall of Fame, high school, college, and pros. So I learned from the best.
Yeah, and when you get there in 1969, like you said, the Pittsburgh Steelers have been bad for the previous 40 years, and I don't think they had any playoff wins. Chuck Knoll had to get there, and he had to do a major culture change. So what do you remember about that first year and how Chuck kind of got everything, how he kind of got the ship righted or on its path to being righted?
Well, it was a bad football team. I mean, we won our first game against Detroit. Then we lost 13 straight. And the whole time, it was one of the worst beatings I've ever taken. You know, but you take two or three steps back and you're going to, you know, get sacked. And we had a really good offensive guard and or two offensive guards in a center. Tackles were a little shaky. And I used to tell people, don't hold, because I still had the wheels. I can get away from a lot of people. And because back then holding was 15 yards. All of a sudden you end up first and 25. That's not going to work. Yeah. You know, might as well punt on second down. But it was, you know, you could, and Chuck was always reassuring. It's going to get better. It's going to get better. But you got to give it to the Rooney family. Because in this day and age, if you hire a coach and he goes 1-13 the first year,
fired.
80% of the coaches are going to fire him. You know, the owners. But the Rooney stuck with them because they knew they had the right man and just had to take patience.
And well, and that patience has turned out good for the Rooney family because I was born in 1968. Chuck Knoll was hired right after I was born. There's only been three coaches for the Pittsburgh Steelers in those 54 years, which is a testimony to the loyalty that the Steelers and the Rooney family shows. And I think that loyalty is a big reason why they've been so successful, even just the way they treat former players.
I think what, and I've told this to many people, that all athletic directors and the powers to be at colleges and the university or at pros should go spend a day with the Rooney family and just ask them, how do you find the right guy every time? Because you got to realize, you know, Chuck Knoll set the foundation. Bill Cowher came in afterwards. Then Mike Tomlin. All three were in their 30s when they started. All three were pretty much unknown.
Yeah.
And they're all defensive assistants. And they all won Super Bowls. So the Rooney family has done a pretty damn good job of picking the right people.
Yeah, and those Steeler drafts in the 70s, starting with 69, Mean Joe Green, yourself, all the way up to 74, maybe the greatest NFL draft the team's ever had. But 1970, did you have any inclination going into that draft that they may draft another quarterback?
No, back then, you know, you got to realize there was no internet, there was no ESPN, so people didn't get noticed as much.
Yeah.
So I didn't know anything about Terry Bradshaw until basically the draft. And I'll never forget, I was in basic training in the Army, down at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and I get a call in my barracks to go to the office. There's a phone call for me, and it was Chuck Knoll. He called me at basic training. Here I was, just depressed as hell. you know, after getting beat up, you know, 1-13 year.
Yeah.
And 2 weeks later, I was in the National Guard. And you know, he said, listen, you had a great year. We just want to bring in competition. We drafted Bradshaw number one. And I said, you know, I said, I don't have a problem with that. Competition is, you know, good for both. So that's what happened.
So how did you and Bradshaw get along, especially
very
that
well.
First year?
Very well. To this day, we I just saw him at Franco Harris's funeral. And we were very close back then. He'd come to my house for dinner and for big holidays and whatnot. And I was in his wedding party. And it wasn't funny, but you know, we're sitting at the table after the service, you know, having a little lunch afterwards. And Terry looked at me and says, you know, I wish you were my quarterback coach when I was playing. I went, wow. Yeah, that would have been good because there'd have been those 2 years there that we didn't win Super Bowls. We would have won Super Bowls.
Yeah.
So that was pretty interesting.
Yeah. And like I said, you were a Steeler fan and you were there on the field, the Immaculate Reception, which was the first Steeler win in playoff history for the Steelers, I believe, wasn't it?
It was an interesting play too, because I was about 5 yards from Franco catching that ball, because everybody, you know, even Mr. Rooney, he came down from the press from his box. He thought the game was over. He was in the elevator when this all happened, and so everybody was going, "Oh boy, it's over with." And all of a sudden, Terry goes back and he's scrambling around, and the ball goes in the air, and you go, "No!" And then I thought for sure Franco was going to get knocked out of bounds on about the 6-yard line. But he moved the ball past them, and it was you know, the Immaculate Reception. It was unbelievable. It put a whopping $5,500 into everybody's pocket.
Well, that was a lot of money back then.
Back then, that was a good payday. Today, you know, that's their beer money.
Yeah, they wouldn't get out of bed to play for $5,500 today, Terry.
No.
and people don't realize how good that Steeler team was even then, because the next week they played the undefeated Dolphins, and you guys only lost that game 21-17, and that was a game that you guys easily could have won.
And that was a fake kick.
Yeah.
If you ever saw that film, and it was Seipel, I think, was,
yes,
was the guy, the kicker, and our guy did not keep contain. He saw that, and he was running down the field as we're screaming from the bench, "It's a fake! It's a fake!" And it was like our line was setting up almost like they were going to block for Seipel. And, you know, he ran about 30 yards first down, and, you know, that carried him on.
Yeah, and I know you were friends or are friends with one of the most interesting athletes ever, which would be Rocky Blyer, who, of course, was injured in Vietnam, had to make the big comeback. They made the movie Fighting Back about him. I know he's been on our show 5 or 6 times. He's a great guy. And just talk about, you know, the backfield there, Franco Harris and Rocky Blyer. I mean, Frenchie Fuqua, and it was a legendary backfield. And those were guys that I would think would have been awesome to play for, because you guys looked like there was a big bond camaraderie with that team.
Well, it was a very close team, and we did a lot of things socially together. I think that's what really kept the bond together. And Rock, like you say, you know, we played together at Notre Dame, and, you know, to this day, he's a dear friend. I just talked to him the other day, and it was some other project. And no, it was people. He doesn't get enough credit, you know, because he came back and stayed with me and my family when he came back from Vietnam, stayed for, you know, a month or so, and we worked out together. And he couldn't, you know, get to the line of scrimmage on just a straight dive without a limp. And I'm saying, why the hell are you doing this? Because Mr. Rooney already told him, listen, Rock, I'll pay for all your law school at Duquesne University. It's all on me if you don't want to play any more football. And he kept saying, no, I want to try it. I got to try it. And for him to rush for 1,000 yards with shrapnel still in his leg is incredible. And that was back when 1,000 yards meant something. That was only 14 games.
Yeah.
You know, nowadays, 17 games, that's no big deal. But Rock is, and he doesn't get enough credit for his blocking ability. He's the one who set the edge for a lot of Franco's runs. And Franco would have even admitted that, you know, Rock either knocked down the linebacker or the defensive end.
Yeah. Neither one of them would have been any good or as good without the other one.
No, exactly. It was a good tandem.
And you had a great offensive line, maybe the greatest center of all time. Mike Webster anchored that line. Of course, we know how that ended up, unfortunately. But that was just, I think, the most complete football team I've ever seen. Because if you look at it, the first two Super Bowls when you were there, that was a team that won with defense. By the time you get to Super Bowls 13 and 14, they're scoring over 30 points in both Super Bowls.
Yeah, you know, the defense always comes up first and everything. And, you know, Chuck Noll knew that, you know, you build from inside out. You know, he drafts Joe Green, number one, because he's going to solidify that defensive line. Then, you know, we went and got Webster, and you got John Cole becoming in my draft. And, you know, some of these guys were just, and you know, Jerry Moon Mullins was a tight end at Southern Cal. They saw him more as a guard, being a wonderful guard. And, you know, they just sort of plugged people in. And Chuck knew that you had to have that offensive line.
Yeah.
Which
and
very few people know that anymore.
Well, ask Coach Prime in Colorado. Go out and get a bunch of skill position guys and forget to get linemen. It turns out bad. When we talk about football today, let's look at Notre Dame. What's your take on Marcus Freeman and the where Notre Dame's program sits right now under Coach Freeman?
Well, I think Marcus is the best thing to happen to Notre Dame in an awful long time. I think he really gets it. And if you see what he's done that Brian Kelly never did, he's building depth. We're getting a lot of four and some five-star kids, but he's building really good depth. We haven't been this deep in many, many years. And it shows because there's going to be injuries in any football game.
Yeah.
And so you really have to do that. And I think the kids respect him. And I think, you know, they played very well last year. Maybe he had a little couple, you know, stubbed his toe a couple times, but he's again a young coach. And people keep saying, well, he's never been a head coach, you know, how could he get such a job? And I said, like I said earlier, you go back to Chuck Noll, Bill Cowher, Mike Tomlin, all in their 30s, all defensive assistants, all getting their first head coaching job. And they all won Super Bowls. So I think Marcus will do that for Notre Dame.
Yeah, I think he was a great hire. And then, of course, you talk Coach Tomlin and the Steelers. I think the question with the Steelers is, in a division with Joe Burrow and Lamar Jackson, do they have a quarterback in Kenny Pickett that could get this done? And I think with Kenny Pickett, the big issue was Matt Canada.
Well, I don't know whether, you know, you have to be there in order to see exactly what's going on. And, you know, Canada, I don't know. I think that Pickett, I think the jury is still out. He hasn't, you know, been around that long. And I think, you know, I was really happy to see Rudolph, Mason Rudolph, get a shot this year because I always liked him coming out of college. I thought
he played really well, too, at the end of the season.
And he took, you know, he's had one of the roughest trips through is, what, 6 years or whatever it is. And never even playing. How can you be so critical of a kid who's never really got on the field and screwed up? You know, he just, you know, he got bad-mouthed right out of the box from Roethlisberger when he got drafted, and Ben didn't give him any help whatsoever, and he sort of learned on his own. And I was happy the Steelers stuck with him and kept him on there until he got his opportunity, and he looked wonderful. I thought he was, I thought of all the three quarterbacks and their playing time they had last year, I think Mason Rudolph was the best. But are you stuck with three backups? I don't know. I don't know if there's a real starter in there. And again, you got to go back to the offensive line. You got to get protection up front for any quarterback to be successful.
Yeah, but the amazing thing, though, is the team gets outscored the way the Steelers did, still go 10-7 and make the playoffs. I think that's a huge testament to the toughness Mike Tomlin instills, just like Bill Cowher and Chuck Noll did.
Well, that's the whole defensive scheme. You know, you're going to win with defense. I don't care what the offense does. We're going to hold the team down. And, you know, we've done it over the years.
So what's your take on the Super Bowl coming up between the 49ers and the Chiefs? Who do you like there?
Well, first of all, I got to say that I am the worst picker of football games ever. But I'm on a hot streak, and everybody's in awe, all my friends, because they used to call me up and get my picks, then go the other way and win. But now I've really screwed them up because I've hit five out of the last six. And I've always picked, I think the two best teams are the 49ers and and Kansas City. I'm a big Andy Reid fan, and I think the quarterback is incredible. I think he just does some things that no other quarterbacks have ever done, Mahomes. But, you know, I think a real thing for San Francisco is that I've been a little concerned about their edge guys.
Yeah.
You know, Bosa and Young. When I saw them playing in the middle of the year, they just disrupted deep offenses. In the last couple of games, they haven't been that big a deal. So I would think that they really have to come out and put a big, because you gotta contain Mahomes.
I would say this, though. I think the Lions and the Packers both have better offensive lines than the Chiefs. I think the Chiefs' interior offensive line is extremely good, but their right tackle and left tackle, I think, are a little bit weak. Maybe they can take advantage of that.
I agree. I agree 100%. And the right tackle's, you know, he's got more penalties than anybody in the NFL.
But my biggest concern, if I'm a 49ers fan, is the way the ball was run on them by Green Bay and Detroit. Especially Detroit, I think they had like 150 yards at halftime. And with Isaiah Pacheco, that's a guy that I love to watch run, because I don't know if I've ever seen too many people run harder than that kid.
The question is
Kansas City going to come out and try to establish the run, or are they going to do what they normally do and just come out and throw the ball?
Well, I think they'll attempt to run the ball, but their game is throwing the ball.
Yeah,
I mean, I think Kelce, as much as you keep hating to see Taylor Swift up there.
Oh yeah,
he had a phenomenal game.
Oh, he had a great game. He started to look like he was getting old as the season went on, and then once the playoffs hit, especially from the Buffalo game to this game, he may be the greatest tight end ever played a game.
Yeah, it could be. He surpassed Jerry Rice. Come on, I mean,
I will give you this though. There's more playoff games played now than there was when Jerry was.
And it's a bigger passing scheme too.
Yeah,
it's very difficult to compare the two generations. You know, in my day, if we threw the ball 20 times, that's putting it up there pretty good.
Yeah,
but nowadays, you know, they do that in the first half.
But that's because they changed the rules, around 75 or 76, which was much more conducive to the defense or the offense having the advantage, too.
Well, that's the old Mel Blount rule.
Yeah, the greatest cornerback that ever lived.
By far. And people try to compare Deion Sanders to Mel. There's no comparison whatsoever. No. I mean, Deion was much better at him than Mel catching the ball. If Mel could catch the ball, he would have had 100 interceptions.
Well, I think he was close to 50 anyways.
Yeah, but he dropped so many. It was unbelievable. But with Mel, there wasn't anybody tougher tackling and just playing cover. The guy's almost 6'4", and he ran a 4'4 and change 40. So he could fly, and he was tough. And, you know, Deion is a great center fielder. If I was playing against Deion, I would have thrown screens at him. I would have run sweeps at him, make him tackle, make him get in the game.
Yeah, but all right, Terry. Hey, it was great having you on the show.
Anytime, Mike. You got my number. Let me know.
Yeah, I got your number. Maybe we'll do something during Super Bowl week or something. Have you on? Talk about your Super Bowl experiences, Super Bowl 9 and 10. But I want to thank you for coming on today, Terry. Even though you are a Steelers fan, I got my Bengals helmet here.
I see that there. We beat that helmet many times.
Hey, you. Well, yeah, I know. But
Kenny Anderson deserves to be in the Hall of Fame.
He's definitely. I mean, if Dan Fouts is in the Hall of Fame, Kenny Anderson should be in the Hall of Fame.
And Kenny, I remember the time Kenny completed, I think, 21 out of 23 against us.
Yeah, I remember that.
He could not miss.
Was it the 75 season?
I'm not sure what it was. I just remember that game just sticks out at me.
Yeah, he was a great quarterback who gets not near the credit. Plus, he's a really great guy too. If you've ever met him.
I understand that.
All right, guys, I want to remind you, is there anything you're doing right now you want to plug or anything, Terry?
No, we're all good right now.
All right, you can follow me on X at Grueling Truth. Make sure you check out BetMGM. Click the links in the description down below if you're watching on YouTube. But for now, for Terry Hanready, I'm Mike Goodpaster. You've been watching and listening to The Grueling Truth, where the legends speak. All right, Terry. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay, Mike. All right, man.
All right. Be safe.
You too. Take care.